in that cable. There's only a microcycle in that cable. You're feeding, the cable thinks you're feeding it a DC voltage.
Wait, what do you mean by low? What about 400 megs? What about 1,000 megs?
At 1,000 megs, the cable has no capacitance. Put a 50-ohm resistor at the end of the cable and make a capacitance measurement. There is no capacitance. It is a pure 50-ohm resistor, whether the cable is an inch long or a mile long. Terminate the cable in its characteristic impedance, 50 ohms, and it is not a capacitor. It is not an inductor. It is 50 ohms, period, DC to light, until you start multimolding the cable with waveguide. We won't go there. You only think you see capacitance of the cable if it is an open circuit. You are now using it as a stub capacitor. That's why you measure 27 picofarads per foot. When it's 50 ohm terminated, there happens to be a zillion series inductors and a zillion tiny little capacitors that all go together and make this crazy circuit that looks like exactly 50.0 ohms when the end of the cable is properly terminated.
See, okay, that's what I was looking for. Okay, now you hit the nail on the head. That's what I wanted. Okay, that I got.
That's why they call cable surge impedance. If I've got a roll of 5,000 feet of cable, and the end of the cable is buried somewhere in the center of that reel, and I can't get there, and I can't terminate it with a 50-ohm load, but I want to know what is the impedance of the cable. I put a very brief pulse down that cable, and I measure the impedance. If I make the pulse brief enough, so the pulse doesn't get a chance to go all the way down to the end of the cable, see the open circuit, and reflect back. If I make the pulse quick enough, that's the surge, I will measure 50.0 ohms. That's why they call it surge impedance. Make the event brief enough, and the signal that starts going down the cable can't tell if the cable is an inch long or a mile long. It'll look the same. Back to you, Andy.
Okay. Now, as soon as you said when there is no capacitance, when it's terminated in 50 ohms, okay, that's what makes sense. Now I understand. Because they don't, you know, I'm not sure about the latest radio amateur's handbook, but they don't clarify it the way that you're explaining it of how they measure the velocity factor and the effects that it causes. Other than that, it slows down the wave going down the cable, which effectively makes the wave look as if it's a lower frequency.
Give that man a cigar. Hey, Andy, you got your money's worth tonight. Mel is the chief financial officer. You've gotten something from this class. We're going to send you a bill. You're going to have trouble paying it. Back to you, Andy.
I'm afraid of that. All right, I got to run because I got to go to work tomorrow. I got to go a little bit earlier. Thanks. I would have come on earlier, but I was tied up. Back to you, and keep up the good work, WHCDL. I'll just be listening just for a little while.
Hey, you could eat YY.
Joe recognized. And you could put the handy talkie alongside of your pillow and listen to Mel and Dick as you go to sleep. Go ahead, Joe.
I have a good antenna question for you. Ready for this one?
Tonight is the night for antenna questions. Give a little bit of delay because I thought I heard somebody briefly in there. That might be another person.
Dick, I want to just give Paul a little information before he leaves. Unless he's gone already. K2KEY.
Sounds like Paul's there. Go ahead.
We got off the subject that we were discussing, Paul. But if you want to read about the hypervertical antennas, it was reviewed years ago by this fellow I know. I'll give you his call letters. You could go to QST and read his reviews on vertical antennas, elevated feed, exactly what we were discussing, and he'll tell you exactly what he found through experiments. Very interesting article. So just go to QST and Google into or add into the QST, you know, when they ask you for keywords, Victor Echo 3, Charlie Victor, VE3CV. His name is Jack Belrose. Paul, did you get that? Over.
Victor Echo 3. What was it? VE3 what? Say again?
Victor Echo 3, Charlie Victor, CV. He did all the analysis on these type of antennas. He'll tell you about the ones he homebrewed, quite an article, and tell you what he found in his experiments with those antennas. And I was going to get into another version of somebody else sent me some information tonight, but I guess I don't know if we'll be able to jam it in. But look at the E3CV and see what he has to say about vertical antennas. Very, very interesting information. Very, well, he goes into some technicalities, but you'll get a good foothold on what it's all about, Paul, over.
Very good, Mel. Thank you for that. Yeah, I'm more interested in tuning up on all these different bands with one coaxial cable. I've already worked the world already with dipoles, so I'm not interested in doing that all over again, but I'd be happy to get on on the bands and just, you know, rag tube, Mel. So I think it would fit my bill pretty good for that purpose. I'm not looking for a lot of gain. I don't care. One coaxial cable with a lot of bands, that sounds good to me. So, but I'll look into this. I got the guy's call. Thank you, Mel.
Very good, Paul. Like I say, the antenna works. I will not say it don't work. And I will say if you want something with a small footprint, simple to put together, rugged construction, these antennas do fit the bill, Paul, as long as you understand the constraints of what to expect. All right, that's it. Turn it back to Dick. And you can, in fact, I was looking at several versions of it here. I got the catalog out that they sent me. And there are ones that they have that do require additional radios. The one you're talking about, the Titan, DX is the one that has the counterpoise system as part of the antenna. Okay, with that, back to you, Dick. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, hopefully Joe's got one of these very simple antenna questions. We'll answer it and then get to the mailbag. I know there's not a lot of time left. I'm having a little fun with you, Joe. V2RYY, a little delay, K2RYW.
Okay, the antenna question is on an antenna that is used for transmitting and receiving at the same time. I have a brand new Superstation Master. Just pulled it out of the tube about a week and a half ago. Set it up on my property to be able to test it for in lieu of putting it up at a repeater location where my repeater is. I'm running this thing about 135 feet of half-inch heliac cable. And I tested the other day using a 100-watt repeater with a duplexer and a preamp on the repeater. I set up a signal generator transmitting off another antenna to be able to totally test the thing without using any kind of directional couplers with it or a way of inserting the signal to the transmission line, just through air induction. Now, the other day, I set this up and ran the test running the repeater on and off for, say, like a period of about 15 minutes, and I didn't get any interaction. There was no descents on the receive frequency when the transmitter was energized, and the duplex is tuned correctly, and it doesn't have any issues with it as far as because I tested with a dummy load also, so it's not a part of the equation here. This past Saturday, I think when it started raining quite a bit, I said, well, let me give a test of this thing during the rainstorm, when it was raining rather heavily through the morning and afternoon on Saturday. All of a sudden, I started getting intermittent type of operation. I was getting, you know, a descent, so it changed by a factor of sometimes 10 to 20 decibels. So I'd have to increase the generator that much for the signal to be heard the same in the receiver. Later on, much later on that day, changing nothing and just letting the rain stop and dry out, all of a sudden they went back to this condition before it rained. Any explanation for this? I don't think the antenna leaks water because it looked like it was perfectly dry in the weep hole at the bottom of the antenna.
If I understand you correctly, 20 decibels of receive sensitivity changed in the rain. I'm finding it very difficult to believe that the water droplet sitting on the outside of the radome of the antenna created that amount of detuning. Describe to me how you measured 20 decibels of descents. Was there VSWR? Was there some of the transmitter signal? Was that getting into the receiver? Was that the kind of descents? How were you measuring sensitivity to sense 20 decibels of descents? How was that measurement made, Joe? Go ahead.
Quite simple. He took the signal unit and increased the output level 20 decibels during this condition. That's how I measure 20 decibels of signal change. The dial setting was, say, arbitrarily something like minus 60 dBm coming out of one antenna, and I received it at a fairly weak signal, and knowing what the level is, actually putting the signal generator directing the repeater input and listening to the receiver signal coming to the receiver through the preamp, you're talking about hearing a level of that about minus 125 or so, approximately for a little less than 20 dB acquiring, something somewhere around that quite a figure. It's pretty hot with a preamp on it. All right, so the signal coming out of one antenna was minus 60, so there's enough path force between point A and point B, and arrives in the antenna, goes back to the receiver, and that's how I know what kind of level I'm talking about. So I had to increase the dial setting up to minus 40 to get the same kind of level, and it wasn't in a condition where it was continuous all the time. It actually changed. Sometimes you'd hear the level wouldn't take quite as much to do it, maybe only 15 or 10 or 15 decibels. Sometimes it'd take as much as 20 decibel increase. And it was an intermittent type of noise, like background noise, almost like the thing had like a bad antenna connection within the elements itself in the dipole. Dipoles of the array inside. It almost sounded like the same kind of problem, but after it dried out, problem seemed to have gone away. Any ideas?
Wow. You've given me two scenarios with your words as to how you made the measurement. You made it sound like you've got two antennas separated by some distance. You're feeding either a minus 60 or a minus 40 dBm signal into one antenna while receiving the other. Then you told me you're injecting a signal of minus 120. So you were either using one of these light coupling T connectors near the receiver and injecting a signal to measure sensitivity, or you were injecting a signal of either minus 60 or minus 40 into a second antenna, into the antenna under test, while the transmitter was turned on. This is a repeater you're testing. So I'm not quite sure which scenario you had. I don't know how many feet of separation between the two. I know a preamp was involved. I know the shielding of a preamp can be very critical in a desense test. So there's quite a number of variables here. Give me a little more. Don't tell me what you did to change the dial from minus 60 to minus 40 and a 20 dB change. That I've got. Tell me the functional block diagram as to how you had this all set up. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, the repeater station puts out approximately 100 watts of power. The duplexer has about maybe slightly more than 1 dB of loss on each port, on the receive port and the transmit port. So say it's putting out 80 watts out of the duplexer from 100 watts going in. All right, somewhere around that figure. If I take the repeater and put it not into transmit, but just receive and listen on a local speaker with a test set, and I put a signal into the antenna input of the duplexer where the two cables go together, same with which would go to the hard line. The generator can now be at about minus 125 to hear a signal, a quieting signal in the receiver at a little less than 20 dB of quieting. That's how I know the receiver is working correctly through the duplexer, through the preamp, and into the repeater receiver. That's how I know the whole chain of everything is working correctly. So knowing that, I now take the same generator and have put it onto an outside antenna aimed somewhat at the antenna I'm probably trying to test out in the yard, and it took a minus 60 decibel signal, minus 60 dBm signal, into that antenna to give me the same equivalent sensitivity on the air between antenna A and antenna B as receiver as I heard it before. Okay, you got that?
Almost. Where the receiver and transmitter section of the duplexer came together, there's usually a T connector. I presume downrange of the common lead of the T-connector, where the antenna transmission line goes, in that common lead, you injected with some kind of a light coupling device a signal. And after calibration, you figured out that it takes minus 120 to do that. That's how I think you measured the sensitivity of the receiver before you turned on the transmitter of the repeater. I presume the 20 decibels of descents only occurred when the transmitter was running, that you didn't have any descents without the transmitter of the repeater running. That's assumption number one. And then with that transmitter running of the repeater, again, you either inject the signal into that light coupling device in the common lead transmission line going to the antenna, or by an external antenna spaced someplace from the first antenna, you injected a signal of minus 60 or minus 40. You've given me both. I don't know what you did when. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, take the word coupling device out of the picture. I didn't use any kind of coupling device except a piece of quarter-inch superflex cable going between the generator and the duplexer. Okay, nice shielded cable. I put the signal into the duplexer exactly at the same point you'd be putting the antenna connection to your antenna, like where the hard line would go, okay, on the center of the T connector. And the other side of the duplexer, one side goes to your transmitter, one side goes to receiver, also through using highly shielded cable, okay? And then a receive light between the duplexer and the repeater is where the preamp is, okay? So once I put the signal into the input side of the duplexer, the antenna side of the duplexer, I measured the effective sensitivity that the receiver was delivering performance-wise with the generator directly connected to the duplexer. And once I knew that reading, I then took the signal and put it to an external antenna on my house and hooked up the hard line feeding the station master. The new station master also set up on another part of the property. And then I increased the generator accordingly till I got the same equivalent signal into the repeater receiver. This is all with the transmitter off. Then I turned the transmitter on while I still was listening to the receiver speaker. Okay, so transmitting and receiving at the same time. When I first did the test, on a dry day, I got virtually no descent, maybe one or two decibels of, I had to increase the generator. So, that small amount of descent I was willing to perfectly accept. It's probably normal in a case like this, okay? And I let the transmitter on for quite a while, heated up the PA really, really good, and then I repeated the test the other day during the rainstorm. And during the rainstorm, I got a change of about 15 to 20 decibels. I'd have to increase the generator by that much to give me the same signal back into the receiver, or what it would effectively hear as I did on the day before on a dry day. And I'm trying to figure out what was causing this problem. It's a brand new antenna I just pulled out of the tube about a week and a half ago. It wasn't left outside at all, so I don't think the thing had water in it at all. It's a brand new antenna. And I couldn't see any water at the bottom of the weep hole coming out of the antenna. So as far as I could tell, it was dry inside the antenna. And the cabling at the bottom was taped up enough where no water or moisture was getting back into that type of connector. That was also dry when I took it apart. Any ideas what you think it is?
I've got another question or two, Joe. When you saw during the rainstorm 20 decibels of descent, while the second antenna on the property had to have a 40 signal instead of a minus 60 signal, 20 dB more signal, in order to get up to the receiver sensitivity. If during that descent test, you turned off the transmitter of the repeater, would you have come back to normal receiver sensitivity, minus 60 on the second antenna? Go ahead.
Yes, affirmative.
Beautiful. Glad you did that test. Now describe the environment of the antenna that's brand new. Was it mounted on your chimney, above the roof of your house? Was it mounted on a tower? What is in the first 10 feet? In other words, if I took the center of that new antenna from the place where you did this test, and I take a 10-foot long tape measure, and I move it in every possible angle so I find out every bit of hardware that's within 10 feet of that antenna, describe that environment to me.
It was mounted on an outside fence about maybe 8 feet above the ground, and the only thing near it horizontally was a neighbor's pine tree, or part of a pine tree. That was within 10 feet.
Whoa. You mounted it on a fence. What's that fence made out of?
Metal.
Don't tell me it was a chain link fence.
Yes, it was.
Wow. Wow. Were there any rusty bolts in your environment?
Perhaps. You think that where it's coming from?
Tell me how many contact points you have in a chain link fence. If I study a chain link fence, I've got what looks like a zigzag of a wire that goes vertical. Right alongside of it is another one woven to it. Right another of it is another one woven to it. You've got a zillion contact points without any kind of soldering or welding on all of those zillions of metal contacts on that chain link fence. Are you slowly getting the picture here, Joe?
Yeah, I am. You think the rain on the fence was causing the actual descent to the antenna system that's picking up?
All you had to do is go out there while the transmitter is running at a safe distance with a long wooden pole and wiggle that chain link fence on a dry day, and you would have seen all kinds of cracklies.
That's easy enough to do that.
Yeah, when rain gets on that... First of all, the surface of a galvanized fence has a whole bunch of zinc oxide. Therefore, each of those thousands of contacts on all of those woven joints of that chain link fence are all making what NASA calls MIM junctions, metal, intrinsic metal. You've got a zillion junctions there. Add some rain to those junctions and apply some RF to them, and you've got the equivalent of, I'm going to pick a number, 50 rusty bolts in the near field of that antenna. Over to you, Joe.
Okay. So if that's the case, how would you test a station mast like this? Take it and put it completely away from a fence like that?
Let me change the scenario. What do you think would happen if at the permanent location point of your repeater, if you took a 5-foot length of chain link fence, hung it on some wooden poles, let it wave in the breeze 5 feet away from your operating antenna? If you were foolish enough to run that experiment on a windy day, tell me what you think you would see.
Well, I have heard the effect you're talking about when I move something metal, something like, say, for example, I'm listening on a receiver at my house and I got my node running. Just the RF from that node putting out, which is about 20-some watts. If I wiggle my car keys, for example, near my portable, I can hear the type of static you're talking about in the receiver. But it's nothing like this type of descent signal I heard in a repeater signal. It doesn't sound like the same thing at all.
Yes, I'll admit that the keys are making very finite contacts and breaking contacts at a very slow rate. But now you get a whole lot of those MIM junctions on all of that zinc oxide, on all of that galvanizing of all of those individual junctions on that chain link fence, and you add water to that mixture. At the microscopic level, boy, you've got all kinds of fancy RF chemistry taking place. And is that a noise generator? Wow. This isn't too different from the problem that NASA ran into, where on the 260-foot Goldstone dish in California, in Mojave Desert, California, on a windy day, when they're listening to a weak signal coming back during the Apollo mission on 2,000 megacycles, as the wind blows the dish and flexes the dish and the individual riveted metal plates of that dish rub past each other microscopically, they get bursts of noise on every gust of wind. And that is a kind of descent that they had. And let's see now, 2106.4 was the transmit frequency, 2287.5 was the receive frequency. They're separated by, what is that, 21, 22, separated by 100 and some odd megacycles. And boy, did they get descents. You don't want any kind of discontinuous metal junctions in the vicinity of an antenna that's doing anything like repeater service. You and I have often heard the story of what happens on a radio tower if there happens to be a single rusty bolt in the vicinity of your operating repeater site. You're going to be unhappy on a windy day. But, I'll admit on a windy day you get scratchies which come in bursts. But in the case of all of your junctions with water in those junctions, I see a mechanism here by which you can get a continuous noise of descents, and you've experienced it. It's the environment you put that poor antenna into, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll have to maybe try to think of some other way of testing the thing, moving away from the fence and find out something else, someplace else to be able to attach the thing and get it to vertically, you know, horizontally. give some vertical space between the ground and it to simulate a little better environment. Maybe it can do a little better test that way. I don't think the Fed's going to bother it that much, but you live and learn.
No, I'm glad you did this, Joe. This is a real eye-opening experience. Out of curiosity, how tall was the fence? How many feet above the ground was the antenna mounting point?
The fence is a short one. It's only about a 4-foot fence, and the pipe I had attached to the fence itself was about maybe 7-8 feet long. So the station was mounted on top of that, the base of the antenna. So the antenna was at the closest point, about 4 feet from the top of the fence.
Yeah, but any metal junctions you've got within, I'm going to pick a number, 10 or 20 feet of that antenna can give you all kinds of grief. And so you either want to mount it on a lone metal pipe that's in the middle of the ground somewhere, nowhere near that metal fence, or maybe to even be one step, a metal pipe, a single metal pipe with a good mounting set of U-bolts to the pipe will do the job very nicely. But when it comes to a nearby scratchy metal thing, that chain link fence is a real eye-opener. Now, I did a slightly more severe test than you 6 months ago. I was working with machinery that does passive intermodulation distortion testing, which is very similar to what you're doing. And I was looking for a two-tone test where the intermods were 150 decibels down or more. And I could stand in front of that particular antenna 10 feet away, jingle the change in my pocket, and I would watch on the spectrum analyzer side lobes that came up at the intermod frequencies 40 dB above threshold. I did the experiment once in the middle of a ordinary house, and all of the metal junctions in the wall of the house, the wiring of the house, gave me a very similar effect. So when you're doing a two-tone test of that nature for PIM testing, or when you're doing a repeater test, you really got to worry about what kind of metal is within 10 or 20 feet of the antenna. There should be nothing with extremely tight bonding, and nothing like compression contacts with oxide in between those compression contacts. You can't do that. That's my experience. And so you brought a very interesting case to our attention here, Joe, and it's a very educational experience. I'm awful glad you did it. We've all learned something by this one. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Now, you say you measured something at a ratio of 150 decibels from the transmitter carrier to the noise floor of some frequency alongside this of what you're trying to receive. How did you accomplish that with the test instrumentation that you had at your disposal?
Okay. If you go to a company called Summitech? Yeah, Summitech, I think is the name of the company, in Colorado. They sell instrumentation that will do for you a passive intermodulation distortion test of cell site antennas. And the specification is a pair of 20-watt signals will create intermodulation distortion minus 150 dB. The instrumentation that does that has got carefully controlled a pair of 20-watt signal generators, circulators, filters. It is a kind of duplexer with additional filters involved to reject the transmit frequency on the receive frequency and vice versa. So it is an extremely elaborate duplexer-like setup of a two-tone test. In that particular case, you're transmitting two signals and looking on a carefully filtered spectrum analyzer for the undesired intermods, the two-tone intermods, third-order intermods. And by specification, they have to be more than 150 dB down from a pair of 20-watt signals. Where's all that dynamic range coming from? Some extremely good filtering and a high dynamic range spectrum analyzer set just right. Over to you, Joe.
This would probably explain what most cell site installations I've been involved with in the past always elected to go with separate transmit and receive antennas. They rarely ever transmit and receive over the same antenna.
You've got it. You're asking for trouble when you transmit or receive into the same antenna. The performance of that antenna and every one of those 7/16 DIN connectors have to perform, your hard line, you're putting everything under an extremely severe environment when you transmit and receive from the same antennas. Some cell sites on some of the sectors are doing that, and in some metro areas they get into an awful lot of trouble. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, good. Thanks for the info. Back to the net.
Hey, Mel, we never got to your mailbag tonight. We had an exciting night. If you want to go to one in the 5 minutes we got left, give it a try. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Now, it gets a little too complicated here because I had sectioned off a number of them to continue this thing, the saga on vertical, and a few interesting antennas that I got some info on here from some people, which would be very interesting to discuss. A couple of them are very, seems like they have something going for the design. They are basically homebrew versions, simpler homebrew versions of these verticals that we are talking about that may be quite effective and easy and very cheap to make. What we can, I discuss in those few minutes left, is the propagation report that this is the quietest the sun has been in a minimum of 50 years, and the second quietest that they measured in 100 years, Dick, over.
Yeah, I've been hearing about that. No sunspot cycles, really quiet, nowhere near as many band openings of 20 meters as you'd like to have. We're really down in the doldrums there, propagation-wise. I've been hearing that. And I guess it helped these guys that did the Venus experiment, EVE, Earth, Venus, Earth, that took place in Darmstadt, Germany, a couple of weeks ago. Beautiful experiment. So the sun being quiet, in my opinion, helped that experiment. And let's hope we're not running into another Maunder minimum, so to speak, where we would end up with a very cold winter. I doubt it. There have been past solar cycles, which started off with a considerable delay and a very big quiet period, which once the sun got rolling, it gave us a good number of sunspots downrange. Not a wicked number, but a good number. So, as Yogi used to say, it ain't over till it's over. And better days are coming, sunspot-wise. But it sure is exciting that what it's really proving to everybody who does solar research is that the total amount of knowledge of the sun is continuously increasing, but there's still an awful lot we don't understand about that solar operation. Those neutrinos that weren't were only one-third as many as they were supposed to be. That experiment that was done in the mine out there in the west, with the cleaning fluid in it, that gave us an eye-opening. And now there's a very long quiet period. There's more to be learned, and we're putting up more space probes to learn more. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Well, because of the quiet conditions, they were able to do a number of VHF and UHF experiments, as you said. Now, if we do not see, according to what I was reading, this is the information from NOAA, that if we do not see a beginning of cycle 24 by the fall of the year, it is most likely we are then definitely going into a water minimum. And also, that means it would be not before about 2012 and all would we see possibly any change in radio conditions dealing with the HF frequency. So this is a very unusual thing that we are experiencing that right now, because like I say, we haven't seen anything quite like it in 50 years, and it was not as severe 50 years ago. The last one that was really of the, you know, real severity of a prolonged time of what we would call a water minimum was 1913, Dick, over.
And to your knowledge, did they have extra cold spells in the winter and a much shorter growing season during that 1913 event? I vaguely remember hearing my grandmother telling me that the Long Island Sound in 1913 approximately froze over. She drove her car across the Long Island Sound over to Connecticut. You and I haven't heard of things like that in most of a century. My grandmother was telling me about her doing that in roughly 1913. Over to you, Mel.
That's true. In fact, there was a whole period that in few years before that, when it saw pictures, in fact, going back into the 1800s, where people were walking from Brooklyn to Manhattan, right across the river, that would freeze over in the wintertime. They give me an idea that how much there has been a change in the environment, the weather conditions, the temperature, the winter temperatures. Whether or not this is a natural occurrence or whether it's something else is really on hand with this, but I don't think we're affecting the sun with pollution on the earth. I don't think the sun has any effect, even though some people have already coming up with some real wild nonsense. But the point is that also that they have correlated that the low times in financial so-called recessions, the depressions, have somewhat followed the sunspot cycle to some extent, Dick. So using that as a prediction, we're in for, I'm afraid, a few more years of financial difficulties over.
Oh, well. And you're saying my stock investment and my retirement nest egg is going to decrease some more. Oh, well. Good thing I'm a tough guy. Otherwise, it would really bother me. Thank goodness I'm still working and I've got a cash flow. Here we are worried about global warming and CO2 loading of the atmosphere. And for all we know, the sun is about to give us a cold spell, another miniature Maunder minimum. If that occurs, we're going to wish we had as much CO2 in that atmosphere as possible as far as creating some more thermal heating is concerned. Without that, we're going to have crop failures in the summertime and very short growing periods. Wouldn't that be a kicker? Wouldn't that be a kick in the tail if all of a sudden we have a cold spell and wish we had more global warming? K2KY, K2RAW.
To get the... Krakatoa blew up in the 1880s and caused that repeater. Biggest... So the example of the...
And the repeater did close down. I'm hearing you beautifully coming out of the 147.375 machine, and I'm not transmitting on that machine in order to come back. So you guys have heard TechNet number 1240 of the series that began in September of 1982, going on 26 and a half years ago, on the assumption that Mel and I stay healthy. And equally as persnickety, we'll be back next week, and we'll settle a couple more of these mysteries of RF and antennas and transmission lines. No promises, but the price is right. 73 year old, be kind to each other, and as Mel and Dick would say, see you down the log. K2RIW and K2KEY, TechNet number 1240, we're clear.
MLN, TGO, turn you up.
Reflector 9126, link clear.
We also looked it up online. Eric Paul.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6. STU.
Tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30. Morning. The time is 5 a.m. tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
WA2HCV, this is A2QL.
W2HCV, model.
Good morning, John. I passed by you about 5 minutes ago. I was on the south. I didn't call you. How was your holiday weekend and your Monday morning?
Seeing the holiday weekend, let me think, 563-mile round trip down to Dulles, Virginia, pick up my 13-year-old. Then did the run back yesterday morning, got back into the area around 2 o'clock. Then had dinner, passed out.
Okay, I guess deservingly so. Passed out after a filled weekend, that's for sure. Yeah, that's right, your daughter was... I guess she had a good time, and she, going away for school, right? So, yeah, that was very good. My daughter went down, yeah, something similar. She went down for, to D.C. This is going back a few years. I guess maybe like 5 or 6 years, if not longer. Anyway, she made friends there that she still has today. So that was a good thing. She went to college, she kept in touch with them, and then afterwards she stayed in touch with them. Yeah, it's probably even longer, like 8 years ago. So that was nice. It was real good. I trust she had a great time.
George, she had a fantastic time. Yeah, she made quite the number of friends, and pretty funny. She invited two of them to hook up in the summer over on Far Island for a week. She had called my wife midweek. Mom! One girl's from Georgia, and the other girl's from California EIA, and they breed them bonded, I guess, very well, and the text messaging all the way home from Virginia back to Babylon, and all last night, the text messaging between the three of them just doesn't stop.
Okay, very good. Wow, across the country. Well, I guess things are changing, that's for sure. Things are changing. The world is getting smaller. The world is getting smaller. Oh, is she looking for school anywhere? Does she have anything in mind, or is it still open?
Well, let's see. 13 years old for the last 2 years is I want to be a teacher. She comes back from this trip, she wants to be an archaeologist.
Well, archaeology is good, it's interesting. I don't know how the pay is though. So I guess maybe she'll find out what the pay is. And it may change her mind. I think teaching's maybe more rewarding, quick rewards too. And if it's teaching, we've got a few great schools right here in Long Island for teaching. That's my understanding. Not too familiar, but so we'll see what the future brings and see if she sticks for an archaeologist. Why? What made the big change?
Yeah, hello, George. I have no idea why she came up with this one, but nah, she's really into her music and everything else, so that'll quickly fade. And I think teaching is her
primary goal. That's what her mom used to do. Now she's an administrator. The grandmother was a teacher and administrator. The grandfather, my sister-in-law, you know, so it's in the blood.
This is A2QL, Mom. Very good. Maybe she'll go back. That's what my daughter's doing now. She's teaching. She enjoys the teaching and interacting with the students and all of that. She's doing it for a few years. But she still likes, I guess, the administrative end of it, you would call it. And she still likes, I think she would like to do better. Curriculum. And that end of it. That's what she always says. I ask her, she says, well, I would. She likes interacting with. I guess she don't like the results, and I guess the red tape that comes with it. That's, I guess, the best way to put it. So she's looking to make that change. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But they're constantly changing their minds. So that's what the future holds. But that's good. She's got some other teachers can help her along. It's always nice. It's always real nice. Somebody to, I guess, offer some inside track, if you will. That's a good thing. So she was there for a week. That was nice. Did she enjoy the trip itself? Had she taken a trip before?
Yeah, well, this trip wasn't like any other trip she's been on down to D.C. A lot of times my wife, my mother-in-law, and the girls, they'll run down like an extended weekend. 350 kids divided into groups of 12 or 13. And they littered all of the D.C. area. One day they went to Williamsburg, another day they went to Jamestown. Another day they went to Gettysburg, and they went to the Air and Space Museum, they went to the Spy Museum, the Holocaust Museum. They hit every single monument in D.C. They went to the Capitol. They went to the White House. They saw the man himself, and the man himself said hello to my daughter's group. And then after that, where'd they go? They went to the Ethiopian embassy. Met some people over there and had dinner there, and the kids all opted for the mac and cheese.
Cool. Fun-filled. Filled, anyway, that's for sure. The week was definitely... What's the name of the program? The actual name with the whole thing. What was the name of it?
People to People World Leadership Forum. Started by Franklin Roosevelt. No, wrong. Dwight Eisenhower. I got my presidents mixed up there for a minute. Yeah, Eisenhower started this thing in order to grow goodwill amongst the young people of the world. And basically, this program is worldwide. So now that she did this one, she came home with paperwork to go to Australia for next year. And when I saw the price, I said, oh my goodness. So we got to decide what we're going to do. One less vacation, or, you know, not send her to Australia for 20 days. In the summer.
Oh boy, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. 20 days in Australia, yeah. And you know what? I can't even imagine the airfare alone. What would run, huh? But I guess you'd make a nice vacation 20 days in Australia, but no country, that's for sure. Really no country. Everything's different. We'll have the expedition. There'll be 2 HCB going out to Australia. Unbelievable. I tell you, it's been nice riding today. I'm all the way down by the Cross Island already. We're doing pretty good. I think I left a few minutes early, too. Not by much, 5 minutes maybe. So it's maybe that's what made the difference. That's all it takes on the expressway, 5 minutes either early or later, make a world of difference. So I got to take this vehicle over, drop it off at the dealer. Got a recall on the sensor for the airbag. Say in states where they have snow and possible salt, where they spread salt for the snow, the sensor, they find that it corrodes a lot faster, so they got to put a beefier sensor in. And it just happens to be, like, the day before I received that recall, my gas gauge don't seem to be working. So, take care of that. So that's this afternoon. So W2HCB, this is AA2QL Mobile. Just getting on to the Grand Central from the Cross Island.
All right, George. W2HCB coming into the CIP on the expressway. Yeah, and fun stuff. Three calls on the cars. My mother-in-law's got to drop off her big old Chrysler 300 that my father-in-law wanted so bad before he passed away. So, just got a problem with the transmission. Just tells me, oh, I took it up to the local. The guy over on, I'm like, what'd you take it there for? It was on the warranty. I didn't know. He didn't know. You got less than 36,000 miles on it. You don't own it 3 years. I called Friday afternoon. I called up my buddy at a Dodge dealer, and also a Chrysler dealer, you know. So she's bringing the car, dropping it off there tomorrow. Found out there's a recall on the transmission in the 300, so she's getting a brand new transmission for free.
Wow, good thing that she didn't you realize to let her know. I like the 300. I always liked that vehicle. It's got the smaller windows on the side. It's got that look like what was that? The Plymouth? Back in the 40s, I think, had that. The smaller windows on the side. And, yeah, I like that look. They kind of brought that back a little bit. You got the mean-looking grill. Yeah, I like the look of the car. I guess it is big, though. Maybe that's, yeah, I like that whole look. A recall on the transmission. I guess, I don't know, maybe it was mismatched. The engine, who knows. Otherwise, how's the car? Do you know that, just give you an insight, I guess. If it's riding good. And name here is Freddy, by the way. George is the other early guy. KOP. Which kind of surprised not on. He's usually on early. I usually on early too. I usually just hear him on. And you're also on early every once in a while. But nicely here on the Grand Central also. As into Brooklyn.
Hi, Freddy. Yeah, I get coal plants mixed up. That's one of my defects. Our car is a beautiful riding car. She's got to have the variable cylinder management Hemi in it. Yeah, thing runs fine. The recall, and so she's got a problem in the morning with the training. For some reason, the stall speed is higher than it should be. So, that'll get addressed and fixed. The recall on the tranny. That's a scary one, that recall. In relation to the park pin in the transmission, the park pin may dislodge itself and inadvertently drop the vehicle into park at highway speeds, causing the rear wheels to lock up and loss of control of vehicle.
That's some engineering problem there. You ain't kidding. That's a scary one. Like, what happened there? Somebody dropped the ball on that one. And that's, yeah, I can imagine how they found that out. Usually for them to recall, they have to, they start crunching numbers. And, yeah, that's going to be a tough one. And it's a scary one.
Yeah, right. Can you imagine? Oh, my goodness. Anyway. Going into Casino Boulevard now. Headed down to good old Lower Manhattan this morning. Good old stop on Broadway where there's never any parking.
Broadway, New York, and where?
Right at the split by the bowl.
Oh, downtown. Yeah, good luck with that one. Don't have a view on that one. First thing in the morning, is that an all-day thing? Are you going to leave there early? I guess it'll be okay.
Yeah, I was hoping to be poking into Manhattan already, but I left a little later than usual. I had Tom getting stuff together this morning. Couldn't find this, couldn't find that. Where'd I put this? Where'd I put that? You know.
That's okay. You had a busy weekend. It's a lot. I got my license renewal in the mail. And they have now, for the CDL, they have M endorsement, metal coils. You ever heard of that?
M for what? Metal coils?
That's the same reaction I had. That's exactly what it was. I had to read what, you know, they said the definition of metal coil. I give you a little card in with your renewal. And yeah, M endorsement for metal coils. You transport anything that's a metal coil. What they consider a metal coil is any piece of metal that's wound in the fashion of a coil that weighs 5,000 pounds or more, or if each individual coil weighs less than 5,000 pounds, but the combination of all of them is 5,000 pounds, so then you need that endorsement.
Wow. I know what they're talking about now. I've seen those guys, guys that deliver those big coils of metal to the stamping factories, guys that make the bottle caps and stuff.
Yeah, I see they have those big metal coils. They also have them for, I see them. Gutters. They're breaking this big, and they're heavy, you know. For gutters, to get the high-low, and I was wondering, I don't know if each one is over 5,000, but I'm sure, you know, they load up a truck. It could be over 5,000 pounds. And I guess I'd have to get it for wire and cable. Each, sometimes if these lead-covered cables, each one of a few, it's only 100 or so feet is over 5,000, 6,000 pounds. Sometimes I've carried as much as 6. I never knew that. They said it was since 2003, according to this card I got. And I think you got to go in for a written test. So I have no idea. I have no idea what, you know, it's all about. I'm going to find out.
10-2 Alpha Sierra Sierra.
Regular recognized. Yeah, they're probably going to give you the test on how you should properly secure it to your bed and all that stuff. That's what it's about. Dano gets big coils of metal, slam fin for the baseboard covers. So. But all that stuff gets, I don't know if this stuff comes in a bit better if it comes in a box. I don't remember. Right, guys, take a turn to pass it over to Freddy. W2HCB, just hit the brick wall of red lights over here. Queens Boulevard.
Yeah, I got that license. 2003, that sounds a long time ago. I kind of remember it as about 3 years ago. I guess I was thinking more like 2005. But I got it for carrying electric wire. Electric wire absolutely falls underneath that. Cable con and stuff like that. especially when they tell you the combination is over 5,000 pounds. And the test is just on the strength of chain